Before I start the show, I have a new patron that I need to give thanks to, Koala Sadai, who is my new stone dog. Thank you very much, Koala. You are the best. Stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. I'm trying to figure out what I should do with this part of my intro. Welcome to the 38th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. The Forsaken are always up to something terrible, but did you ever wonder why? A bad childhood? Low self-esteem? Just genuinely evil? In this episode, I ponder what it's like to open your eyes in a world you can't recognize and then have to figure out what you're going to do to cope with it. Imagine what it would be like to wake up from a 3,000-year coma. Even a 40-year coma is a huge amount of time and would be staggeringly hard to deal with. The world changes enough in 40 years that it's a mindfuck even as you're living through it. So the idea of 3,000 years passing as the world changes beyond anything you ever knew, no amount of egomania or malevolent grandiosity can prepare someone for that. And when I think about the Forsaken, I kind of picture them as evil coma patients. That seems like the best lazy metaphor to succinctly sum up their lived experience. In the fires of heaven, we start to get our first POVs from the Forsaken. We don't get very much, but any point of view is enough to seriously humanize a character, especially when it's a Robert Jordan point of view, and POV is the part of literature that he is particularly talented at. Before Book 5, our knowledge of these characters and their general experiences has come from outside perceptions, and then the occasional villain monologue that they are so kind to delight us with. But now we begin the journey of learning about them from themselves. And they are not sympathetic characters, but they are compelling, and the Fires of Heaven gives them real depth. RJ explores their personal stories in Book 5. It's no longer just an external observer narrating what they do. We're beginning to get an idea of who they actually are as people and why they do it. In this book, RJ continues the arcs of the remaining players from what I called the Forsaken Fuckery in Book 3, which are Lanfear, Samael, and Raven, Baelal and Ashamiel having both been disorged. We see an exploration of Mogedion and her beef with Nynaeve. We meet Grendel for the first time, and we explore the aftermath of Lanfear's betrayal of Asmodian. And Jordan doesn't give them significant story-driving narratives, with the possible exception of Raven. His arc is pivotal to the climax of the book, but he does begin to tease us with this running puzzle that's unique to the Chosen of who will be Nae Bliss, and the more significant to the series as a whole question of who will survive to wreak maximum fuckery on our characters and on the world of Randland. Who will be the most effective villain? On the surface, and based upon the encounters that we have with Aghanor and Balthamel at the end of Book 1, the Forsaken leave the Boar ready to just take their evil ways again. They're going to go out and make their mark on this world. But if you actually put yourself in their shoes, with the exception of Aghanor, Balthamel, and Ashamiel, all of whom experienced the passing of time in some way, the Forsaken spent 3 millennia in stasis. And all they know is that they were having a meeting at Shale Ghul, and then Luce Theron Telamon and 100 companions showed up and gate-crashed it, and a battle ensued. And maybe in the moment, as they were starting to get sealed in, there was fear or horror as they began to realize what was happening. But during the story, it is referred to by more than one of the Forsaken that they had a dreamless sleep. And while they must have experienced some kind of passing of time, at least I notice that when I wake from a dreamless sleep, there is a sense of time having passed, they're not stuck in an unending, grinding nightmare like Aghanor and Balthamel, where real-time passage is experienced. Most of the Forsaken came out of the Boar with their mental and physical well-being reasonably intact, and once they were out, I'm wondering if maybe they got a brief update with the Dark One. You know, they chill in the Pit of Doom for a bit, and they're like, hey, what's going on? And he gives them the lowdown. But we know that the Dark One's knowledge is very limited, because in the prologue of Lord of Chaos, he has to ask Demandred, how fares this world? So mostly, I think that when the Forsaken got out, they had to figure out for themselves, like, dude, what happened? As Mogedion and Nynaeve battle in the Panarch's Palace at the end of Book 4, Mogedion villain monologues about the domination bands to Nynaeve. She's trying to distract this long-braided primitive because they're equally matched in power, and so she's telling her, oh, I saw you notice those. You wonder why I left them there? Here, let me tell you about all of the dangers involved with them. And it says, do you wonder how I know all this? The collar and bracelets were made after I was... Well, we will not talk of that. Once I was free, the first thing I did was seek information about those last days. Last years, really. There are a good many fragments here and there that make no sense to anyone who does not have some idea to begin with. The Age of Legends. Such a quaint name you have given my time. Yet even your wildest tales no more than hint at the half. I had lived over 200 years when the Boar was opened, and I was still young for an Aes Sedai. Your legends are but pale imitations of what we could do. So Mogedion dives into research when she gets out of the Boar to figure out, dude, what happened? And that had to be a pretty universal action among the Forsaken. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is a sense of control, and from there, a smidge less anxiety. They don't have anybody to talk to about how scary this situation is. When you're an evil entity who is considered superhuman, you can't really admit that to anyone, particularly because you can't afford to show weakness to your frenemies at best. You can't be like, dude, this is really fucking me up. I did not expect to wake up to this shit show of, for all intents and purposes, being spit back in time. Dude, what happened? The most that they can do is when they're together, or presumably they do it quite a lot by themselves, lament about how much the Third Age sucks, how shitty everybody is with the One Power, how they can't do anything that you used to be able to do, there are no good restaurants anymore, nothing is open after 10, the wine is terrible, and they're just generally elitist snobs, and they talk down about these people who managed to survive the shitshow that they made of the world in the first place. They sound like snooty fucking boomers, and I really feel like Rand and all of the Emmons Fielders should just be like, okay, boomer, every time a fucking Forsaken says anything, because it's sort of like we're living in the shit show that you helped make. How about shut the fuck up with your fucking superiority complex, assholes? The Forsaken are like a coma patient who wakes up, and rather than having to learn how to cope with the massive advances in tech, they have to adapt to a world without it, something that comes with easily as many, if not more, challenges. And honestly, Mogedion's ability to do effective research with no access to the internet is pretty impressive. I'm super impressed by that. Respect. That being said, while Mogedion is known to be a coward, and it's to be expected that she is spending the Third Age living in fear, all of the Forsaken must be scared on some level moving through this world. And I feel like their individual skills and proclivities and motivations determine how well, despite their anxiety of being like, dude, what happened? How well each of them adapts to the Third Age and is able to make their way through it. Most Forsaken look to their power or their glory, but some of them don't. It depends on how prepared they are to cope with life in the Third Age, and also what they actually value, because if there is one thing that RJ loves to explore in the Forsaken, it is that people are evil for different reasons. All of them leave the Boar with some manner of goal, but the goals are varied, from challenge the Creator and get loose Theron to love me, to I want to be nameless, to I want to survive. The Forsaken that we deal with in this book are Lanfear, Ravan, Grendel, Samael, Mogedion, and Asmodian. We are introduced or reintroduced to the first four in Ravan's head. He's the third POV of the prologue. and we come in on him as he is compelling the tower spy, the freshly minted Red Sister that Javindra thinks no one will know as Aes Sedai, except the Black Aja told Ravan right where to find her, and now she sends the tower the messages that he dictates to her. Oops. Lanfear shows up, rather rudely, it's implied, and it says, "Since you avoid the rest of us, a few of the Chosen will be coming here. I came first, so you would know it is not an attack. Others? Some plan of yours? What need have I of someone else's designs?" Suddenly he laughed, a deep, rich sound. "So it is no attack, is it? You were never one for attacking openly, were you? Not as bad as Mogedion, perhaps, but you did always favor the flanks and the rear. I will trust you this time, enough to hear you out, as long as you were under my eye. Who trusted Lanfear behind him deserved the knife he might well find in his back. Not that she was so very trustworthy even when watched. Her temper was uncertain at best. Who else is supposed to be part of this?" And so Samael and Grendel show up, and RJ spins out a scene where we learn a pretty decent bit about these people through Ravan's eyes while their plan is hatched. Grendel makes this comment. "Nearly half the surviving Chosen in one place, and no one trying to kill anyone. Who would have expected it before the great Lord of the Dark returns? Ishamael did manage to keep us from one another's throats for a time, but this..." And Robin's inner narrative here gives us a breakdown of her pets and how she uses compulsion on not just beautiful people, but powerful people. And he's judgy about the way she makes use of compulsion, because she turns people into mindless slaves who worship her and act as objects. She brings two servants with her, one to act as a chair and another as a table, and Ravan thinks it's wasteful, because he uses compulsion much more subtly, and people are useful at that point, because they're useful for more than sitting on or telling him that he's pretty. Or I suppose Ravan would have them tell him his is the biggest. It goes on to say, "Should I expect more, Lanfear?" he growled. "Have you convinced Dima and Dredd to stop thinking he is all but the Great Lord's heir?" "I doubt he is arrogant enough for that," Lanfear replied smoothly. "He can see where it took Ishamael, and that is the point. A point Grendel raised. Once we were 13, immortal. Now 4 are dead, and 1 has betrayed us. We 4 are all who meet here today, and enough." "Are you certain Asmodean went over?" Samael demanded. "He never had the courage to take a chance before. Where did he find the heart to join a lost cause?" Lanfear's brief smile was amused. "He had the courage for an ambush he thought would set him above the rest of us, and when his choice became death or a doomed cause, it took little courage for him to choose. And little time, I'll wager." The scar made Samael sneer even more biting. "If you were close enough to him to know all of this, why did you leave him alive? You could have killed him before he knew you were there." "I am not as quick to kill as you. It is final, with no going back, and there are usually other more profitable ways. Besides, to put it in terms you would understand, I did not want to launch a frontal assault against superior forces." So Lanfear is throwing Asmodean under the bus, and making certain that the others are wary of and worried about Rand. Ravan asks her, is he really that strong? And she's like, duh, he's Luthaeron reborn. And it says, "If this Randall Thor really is Luthaeron Telamon reborn," Grendel went on, settling herself on the man's back where he crouched on all fours, "I'm surprised you haven't tried to snuggle him into your bed, Lanfear. Or would it be so easy? I seem to remember Luthaeron led you by the nose, not the other way around, squelched your little tantrums, sent you running to fetch his wine, in a manner of speaking." She set her own wine on the tray, held out rigidly by the sightlessly kneeling woman. "You were so obsessed with him, you'd have stretched out at his feet if he said rug." Lanfear's dark eyes glittered for a moment before she regained control of herself. "He may be Luthaeron reborn, but he is not Luthaeron himself." "How do you know?" Grendel asked, smiling as if it were all a joke. "It may well be that as many believe all are born and reborn as the wheel turns, but nothing like this has ever happened that I have read. A specific man reborn according to prophecy? Who knows what he is?" Lanfear gave a disparaging smirk. "I have observed him closely. He is no more than the shepherd he seems, still more naive than not." Scorn faded to seriousness. "But now he has Asmodean, weak ally as he is, and even before Asmodean, 4 of the Chosen have died confronting him." "Let him whittle away the dead wood," Samael said gruffly. He wove flows of air to drag a chair across the carpet and sprawl with his boots crossed at the ankle and one arm over the low carved back. Anyone who believed he was at ease was a fool. Samael had always liked to dupe his enemies into thinking they could take him by surprise. More for the rest of us on the day of return. Or do you think he might win Tarmogoyden Lanfear? Even if he stiffens Asmodean's backbone, he has no 100 companions this time. With Asmodean or alone, the Great Lord will extinguish him like a broken starlight. The look Lanfear gave him bristled with contempt. How many of us will be alive when the Great Lord is freed at last? 4 gone already. Will he come after you next, Samael? You might like that. You could finally get rid of that scar if you defeated him. But I forget, how many times did you face him in the War of Power? Did you ever win? I cannot seem to remember. Without pause, she rounded on Grendel. Or it might be you. He is reluctant to hurt women for some reason, but you won't even be able to make Asmodean's choice. You cannot teach him any more than a stone could, unless he decides to keep you as a pet. That would be a change for you, would it not? Instead of deciding which of your pretties pleases you best, you could learn to please. Grendel's face contorted, and Robin prepared to shield himself against whatever the two women might hurl at one another, prepared to travel at even a whiff of balefire. Then he sensed Samael gathering the power, sensed a difference in it. Samael would call it seizing a tactical advantage, and bent to grab the other man's arm. Samael shook him off angrily, but the moment had passed. The two women were looking at them now, not each other. Neither could know what had almost happened, but clearly something had passed between Robin and Samael, and suspicion lit their eyes.
"I want to hear what Lanfear has to say."
He did not look at Samael, but meant it for him.
"There must be more to this than a foolish attempt to frighten us."
Samael jerked his head in what might have been a nod, or merely disgruntlement. It would have to do.
"Oh, there is, though a little fright could not hurt."
Lanfear's dark eyes still held distrust, but her voice was as clear as still water. "If Shamael tried to control him and failed, tried to kill him in the end and failed, but if Shamael tried bullying and fear, and bullying does not work with Randall Thor." There is so much here. First, we see that Lanfear is super sensey about Rand and Luz Theron Telamon, probably about having her obvious and uncontrolled obsession pointed out, and also about how little luck she's had seducing this naive shepherd. So she's touchy about all of that and didn't appreciate having Grendel pointed out as her very savage turning it on her and being like, "How'd you like to be his pet, asshole?" showed. We also see that Samael was going to take advantage of their distraction to kill Lanfear and Grendel. But like Lanfear, Robin is not so quick to kill and doesn't want her Zorch before he knows the real point of Lanfear bringing them all together. So he grabs Samael's arm and distracts him because he's like, "Dude, don't go off and blast them when this could actually be a very profitable alliance, dick." Robin knows that there is more to what Lanfear is doing right here than scaremongering. But his claim that Lanfear's attempt to frighten them is foolish is unfair since A, it works, and B, the fear makes them amenable to her plan. Lanfear is continuing her long game. She is manipulating these frenemies of hers, suggesting that they work together to bring Rand to the Dark One. And we know that she has no interest in bringing Rand to the Dark One with any of them. 3 months previously, when Samael sent Trollocs to the Stone of Tyr, and she first reveals herself to Rand in Chapter 9 of The Shadow Rising, the chapter called Decisions, Lanfear shows up as Selene and then outs herself to Rand and is like, "Oh no, I'm actually Lanfear." And he's like, "Do you mean to kill me then?" And she's like, "No, I mean to have you. You loved me once before the pale-haired milksop stole you." And we get our first appearance of Luz Theron when Rand yells back at her, "And you loved power." And it says, "Selene, Lanfear," seemed as startled as he, but she recovered quickly. "You've learned much. You have done much I'd not have believed you could, unaided, but you were still fumbling your way through a maze in the dark, and your ignorance may kill you. Some of the others fear you too much to wait. Samael, Robin, Mogedion, others perhaps, but those of a certainty. They will come after you. They will not try to turn your heart. They will come at you by stealth, destroy you while you sleep, because of their fear. But there are those who could teach you, show you what you once knew. None would dare oppose you then." "Teach me? You want to let one of the Forsaken teach me?" One of the Forsaken. A male Forsaken. A man who had been Aes Sedai in the Age of Legends, who knew the ways of channeling, knew how to avoid the pitfalls, knew as much had been offered him before. "No,
Even if it was offered, I'd refuse, and why should it be? I oppose them, and you. I hate everything you've done, everything you stand for. Fool, he thought, trapped here and I spout defiance like some idiot in a story who never suspects he might make his captor angry enough to do something about it. But he could not force himself to take the words back. Stubbornly he plowed ahead and made it worse. I'll destroy you if I can, you and the Dark One and every last Forsaken. A dangerous gleam flashed in her eyes and was gone. Do you know why some of us fear you? Do you have any idea? Because they are afraid the Great Lord of the Dark will give you a place above them. Rand surprised himself by managing a laugh. Great Lord of the Dark? Can't you say his true name either? Surely you don't fear to attract his attention as decent people do, or do you? It would be blasphemy, she said simply. They are right to be afraid, Samael and the rest. The Great Lord does want you. He wants to exalt you above all other men, he told me. That's ridiculous. The Dark One is still bound in Shale Ghul, or I would be fighting Tarman Gaiden right now. And if he knows I exist, he'd want me dead. I mean to fight him. Oh, he knows. The Great Lord knows more than you would suspect. It is possible to talk with him. Go to Shale Ghul, into the Pit of Doom, and you can hear him. You can bathe in his presence. A different light shone on her face now. Ecstasy. She breathed through parted lips and for a moment seemed to stare at something distant and wondrous. Words cannot even begin to describe it. You must experience it to know. You must. She was seeing his face again, with eyes large and dark and insistent. Kneel to the Great Lord, and he will set you above all others. He will leave you free to reign as you will, so long as you bend knee to him only once. To acknowledge him, no more than that. He told me this. Asmodean will teach you to wield the power without it killing you. Teach you what you can do with it. Let me help you. We can destroy the others. The Great Lord will not care. We can destroy all of them, even Asmodean, once he has taught you all you need to know. You and I can rule the world together, under the Great Lord, forever. Her voice dropped to a whisper, equal parts eagerness and fear. Two great Sa'angriel were made just before the end. One that you can use, one that I can. Far greater than that sword. Their power is beyond imagining. With those we could challenge. Even the Great Lord himself. Even the Creator. So if ambushing Rand as a group with these other three Forsaken is not Lanfear's game, what is? We know that she has not had a massive change of heart and decided, okay, well, this isn't working with Rand. Now he has Asmodean, so I'm going to go work with these other three of my frenemies to capture him. We know that's not the case, because she shows up in Roydian in Chapter 6 of The Fires of Heaven after Rand is attacked by Darkhounds and catches him as he's in his room, retying the traps and disguising the niche in the wall that he's carved where he's keeping the statuettes of the Chodon Kall. Rand has fought and killed the Darkhounds with Balefire. He's killed the ones that have gone after Matt. Moraine has just sworn to obey him, and he's finally gotten back into his room and had a little bit of privacy, and he's taking advantage of it to check on his secret hiding place when Lanfear pops up, and it says, at the sight of her, his stomach clenched until he wanted to vomit. What do you want? He demanded. Once he had blocked Egwene and Elaine both from the true source, but he could not remember how. So long as Lanfear could touch the source, he had more chance of catching the wind in his hands than of holding her prisoner. One flash of Balefire. He could not do it. She was one of the Forsaken, but the memory of a woman's head rolling on the ground stopped him dead. You have two of them, she said finally. I thought I glimpsed. One is a woman, isn't it? Her smile could have halted a man's heart and made him grateful. You are beginning to consider my plan, aren't you? With those together, the other chosen will kneel at our feet. We can supplant the Great Lord himself, challenge the Creator. You were always ambitious, Mirren. His voice grated in his ears. Why do you think I turned away from you? It wasn't Ilgiana, whatever you like to think. You were out of my heart long before I ever met her. Ambition is all there is to you. Power is all you ever wanted. You disgust me. She stared at him, both hands pressed hard against her stomach, her dark eyes even larger than usual. Grendel said, she began faintly. Swallowing, she began again. Luce Theron? I love you, Luce Theron. I have always loved you, and I always will. You know that. You must. Rand's face was like rock. He hoped it hit his shock. He had no idea where his words had come from, but it seemed he could remember her. A dim memory from before. I am not Luce Theron Telamon. I am Rand Althor, he said harshly. Of course you are. Studying him, she nodded slowly to herself. That cool composure returned. Of course. Asmodean has been telling you things about the War of Power and me. He lies. You did love me, until that yellow-haired trollop Ilyenis stole you. For an instant, rage made her face a contorted mask. He did not think she was even aware of it. Did you know that Asmodean severed his own mother? What they call stilling now. Severed her and let Myrdal drag her away screaming. Can you trust a man like that? Rand laughed aloud. After I caught him, you helped trap him so he had to teach me, and now you say I cannot trust him? For teaching, she sniffed dismissively. He will do that because he knows his lot is cast with you for good. Even if he managed to convince the others that he has been a prisoner, they would still tear him apart, and he knows it. The weakest dog in the pack often suffers that fate. Besides, I watch his dreams on occasion. He dreams of you triumphing over the great lord and putting him up beside you on high. Sometimes he dreams of me. Her smile said those dreams were pleasant for her, but not so for Asmodean. But he will try to turn you against me. Why are you here? He demanded. Turn against her? No doubt she was full of the power right that moment, ready to shield him if she even suspected he meant to try anything. She had done it before with humiliating ease. I like you like this. Arrogant and proud, full of your own strength. Once she had said that she liked him unsure, that Luce Theron had been too arrogant. Why are you here? Robin sent the Dark Hounds after you tonight, she said calmly, folding her hands at her waist. I would have come sooner to help you, but I cannot let the others know I am on your side yet. On his side. One of the Forsaken loved him, or rather the man he had been 3,000 years ago, and all she wanted was for him to give his soul to the Shadow and rule the world with her, or a step below her at least. That, and try to replace both the Dark One and the Creator. Was she completely mad? Or could the power of those two huge Sangreal really be as great as she claimed? That was a direction he did not want his thoughts to take. Why would Ravan choose now to attack me? Asmodean says he'll look to his own interests, that he'll sit to one side even in the last battle if he can, and wait for the Dark One to destroy me. Why not Samael or Demandred? Asmodean says they hate me. Not me. They hate Luce Theron. But to the Forsaken, that was the same thing. Please, light, I am Randall Thor. He pushed away a sudden memory of this woman in his arms, both of them young and just learning what they could do with the power. I am Randall Thor. Why not Semiraj or Mogedion or Grim? But you are impinging on his interests now, she laughed. Don't you know where he is? In Andor, in Camelot itself. He rules there in all but name. Morghais simpers and dances for him, her and half a dozen others. Her lip curled in disgust. He has men scouring town and countryside to find new pretties for him. For a moment, shock held him. Elaine's mother in the hands of one of the Forsaken. Yet he dared not show concern. Lanfear had displayed her jealousy more than once. She was capable of hunting Elaine down and killing her if she even thought he had feelings for her. What do I feel for her? Aside from that, one hard fact floated beyond the void, cold and cruel in its truth. He would not run off to attack Ravan, even if what Lanfear said was true. Forgive me, Elaine, but I can't. She might well be lying. She would weep no tears for any of the other Forsaken he killed. They all stood in the way of her own plans. But in any event, he was done with reacting to what others did. If he reacted, they could reason out what he would do. Let them react to him and be as surprised as Lanfear and Asmodean had been. Does Ravan think I'll rush to defend Morghais? He said. I have seen her once in my life. The Two Rivers is part of Andor on a map, but I never saw a Queen's Guardsman there. No one has in generations. Tell a Two Rivers man Morghais is his queen and he'll probably think you're crazy. I doubt Ravan expects you to run to defend your homeland, Lanfear said wryly. But he will expect you to defend your ambitions. He means to sit Morghais on the Sun Throne, too, and use her like a puppet until the time he can come into the open. More Andoran soldiers move into Kyrian every day, and you sent Terran soldiers north to secure your own hold on the land. No wonder that he attacked you as soon as he found you. If Lanfear is still on Rand's side at the beginning of Book 5, just like she was at the beginning of Book 4, then we can assume that her long game in Book 5 is similar to the long game she was playing in Book 3, except that instead of using and manipulating Rand's peers to effect her plan to aid him, she's using and manipulating her own. Lanfear picks the Forsaken, who are showing they've adapted well to living in the Third Age, to conspire with. Samael, Raven, and Grendel are ambitious. While they all operate in different ways and are motivated by different things, they are also all aimed at concrete and lofty goals. The world of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, which is often called the Big White Book of Bad Art, says about Samael, Estelle Janin Elansar, he was a world-renowned sportsman before the war, competing in a number of events, among them archery, in a sort of bloodless competition with swords at which he was the world champion. He was reportedly friends with Luce Theron Telamon, though the closeness of the friendship cannot be ascertained. With the onset of the War of Power, his other talents were revealed, and he soon became one of Luce Theron's best generals. Without a doubt, he fell in love with war, and very likely with the honors and privileges that went with being one of the best-known and highest-ranking generals. His greatest ability lay in defense, and those fighting the Shadow were often on the defensive. So, Samael, by his very nature, is fairly well-suited to adapt to the Third Age. He is a competitive and combative person with a fundamental drive to win. He was an honored man in the Age of Legends, and he had to have been more than just a famous athlete, because if you read about the Age of Legends in the supplemental source material, it's acts of service that are the most important things. That's how you make your name. The Second Age was like Star Trek. They were dirty socialists, all basic needs are taken care of, and so monetary success is not the be-all and end-all as a measure of greatness, because there are no extremes of the haves and the have-nots. What makes you considered a great person as far as awesome enough to earn a third name is acts of service. And whether Samael's generalship was such a great act or a great service that he got his third name, I don't quite know, but I don't think so, because it says specifically in the text, the way it's worded, that he was a world-famous fencing champ as Teljan and Elansar before the War of the Shadow, so he must have done something noteworthy beyond athletics, because I don't think in the Age of Legends they revered their sports stars so much that they would give them a third name just because they were talented. So Samael must have done something else noteworthy. Regardless, he's really competitive, and competitive in non-team sports. He's somebody who wants to win and isn't necessarily inclined to play well with the others. It's all about him. It's so much about him that he decided to join the Shadow because he felt like he wasn't getting enough attention. But that single-mindedness and love of self makes him somebody who is very adapted to quickly and calculatedly settle down and figure out, dude, what happened? And also, how am I going to cope with this to best effect so I can win? Game on. Raven, on the other hand, was not a special person in the Age of Legends at all. It says, Nothing is known of Arad Mosinel before the collapse, when he appeared among the highest council of the Dark One's forces, and in truth, not a great deal after. There is little doubt that he thirsted for power above all else, and turned to the Dark Lord to satisfy that thirst. It is believed that he used compulsion discreetly, bending minds and wills to assure his constant control of any situation. Under the Shadow, he held both military commands and political office, and while he was a fair general, it was in the political and diplomatic areas that his abilities blossomed, though with a decided bent toward manipulation. He is credited with causing several regions to surrender to the Dark One's forces without actual invasion. The regions he governed for the Shadow were efficiently, if harshly, administered, though often with a lack of attention to detail. Raven's two major weaknesses were his love of sycophancy and his fondness for women. Many people gained positions in his administration by flattering him, though he was quick to remove them if they proved too unsuited to the position. And although a handsome man, he could not stand rejection. His lovers were seldom allowed any choice in the matter. Much of the laxity of his administration could be attributed to time spent with his lovers. So, it is possible that Raven is better at compulsion than I gave him credit for in the last episode. He was a nobody in the Age of Legends. He had no third name to distinguish him, and nothing of him was left behind. He was someone who had appetites and insecurities, and having the ability to use compulsion opened a whole new world to him. Like, huh, here I will suffer no consequences among these people for being able to use this particular tool that will help me get the things that I want. This text is telling us that Raven has deep self-image and self-esteem issues. He is objectively attractive, The High Lady Altima, before he ever touches her with the One Power, is like, wow, he's gorgeous, pant pant. But Raven can't accept that and just feel good when someone is genuinely into him and meh when someone isn't. He has, like, hardcore incel psychology. There are forums where incels will share photos of themselves and pick each other apart, and they'll tell each other how ugly they are and talk shit to each other and say really terrible stuff. And it's like they get off on it. They get off on tearing each other down and on being torn down. But I've read articles and seen pictures that guys will post, and a lot of the guys are actually pretty handsome men. They tell themselves and each other that they're ugly so that it's women's fault they don't want them, because women are shallow. And it's like, bro, it's not that you're not cute, it's that you have personality flaws that make you utterly unfuckable. You are a field of red flags, and your handsome face doesn't make up for the rest of you because you're an asshole. And I'm trying to imagine men who hate women and fear rejection, men who feel entitled to women's bodies, and how scary they would be if they could just compel sex and approval instead of learning how to interact with people and have decent social skills and accept rejection and not take it so personally. Scary. They're scary. And in episode 19, I wondered if Baelal got out of the boar first and jumped on Tyr because it was the most desirable spot thanks to Kalendor. But I realize now that the appeal of a beautiful queen to control and rule through means that even if Tyr were up for grabs, Andor would be Raven's first choice, no matter what. And because he's a rapist, which is something Raven might dispute since he ensures that these women want him, but there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, he's a rapist, and that makes him a Forsaken that Robert Jordan, who shows throughout his work that he finds rape to be basically the most reprehensible thing there is, at least as long as it's happening to women. That makes Raven a Forsaken that RJ is so glad to kill. Raven is actually a really useful character for a good short-lived dynamic role, and then RJ wants him gone because he's disgusting. He's a disgusting piece of shit. Jordan makes it a point to show that even Lanfear is disgusted by him. She calls him a pig when she first comes to talk to him in the prologue, and she's openly disgusted when she tells Rand that he's in Andor using Morghese as a puppet and having men scour the countryside looking for new women. So though Raven is fairly well suited to adapt to the Third Age just as Samael is, he gets got, and good riddance. Grendel is different from the other two that Lanfear approaches, because while it is said that she carved a kingdom out for herself, that's not really true. She could have carved out a kingdom, but chose not to, because Grendel doesn't want to run a country. And the proof that we have of that is the country she chose to occupy. The strongest southern nations had already been taken by others of the Chosen. Tyr, Ilion, and Andor were out of bounds. Kyrian was just as chaotic as Ered Domon. None of the borderland nations seem promising since they're destined to fall first when the Trollocs come. But she had a couple of other countries available that were uniquely suited to her talents had she wanted to engage in intrigue, negotiation, and manipulation a la Raven. Mirindi and Altara are both weak yet stable nations, with nobility that go their own way rather than supporting the ruler, so she could have quickly gone in and consolidated power, using compulsion to draw everyone into line. And while Mirindi might not have been ideal because it's geographically too close to Andor and Ilion, Altara was pretty much perfect. But Grendel doesn't want to rule a nation. She wants to occupy a void. Ered Domon is a shit show. She can direct the chaos to a certain extent, but there's no governance, and that's the point. She wants to be left alone in her pleasure palace with her pets, protected by this storm of anarchy that is in many ways a greater defense than the most powerful army. And it's implied that she's gathering power, but it's more like she's making a vacuum by stealing the powerful, and then from there, she can direct where she wants things to go. The Big White Book of Bad Art says of Grendel, Camarile Maradim Nindar was a noted ascetic, not only living a spare and simple life, but preaching that others should as well. Camarile Maradim was famed and loved around the world, if apparently more often by people who had heard of her than by those who actually knew her. Dedicated to curing those with mental illness that the One Power and healing could not touch, she was possibly the best at subtle manipulations of the human mind who ever lived. Those who knew her well often did not like her. While her public calls for a sparse life were always moderate, in private, she was inevitably abrasive and cutting towards anyone who did not live up to her standards of simplicity, which meant toward everyone. Within 10 years after the bore was drilled, Camarile Maradim underwent a complete metamorphosis, becoming the opposite of all she had been. Extreme hedonism replaced her asceticism. Her simple clothes were replaced with the latest and most daring styles, chosen to enhance her appearance. Sensual and sexual pleasures took primacy over everything else. There is no evidence that this change was caused by the Dark One. Instead, it seems to have stemmed from a realization that the world could never live up to her standards. It may have been her way of showing the world her contempt for what she saw as their way of life by taking that way to its furthest extremes, though she was reported to enjoy her pleasures greatly. Given the troubles sweeping the world at that time, the odd behavior of this world-famous woman excited little attention, but that fact is unfortunate. There is considerable evidence that Camarile Maradim may have been one of the first to discover what the world faced, though not until some years after her change of behavior, when the second of those who came to be called the Forsaken decided to serve the Dark One. She visited Sheol Ghul to make her oaths within the first 25 years of the collapse. So, she was an incredibly judgmental therapist, who presumably felt that everyone would be happier if they lived simpler lives. If her 180 from self-denial to self-indulgence had nothing to do with the Dark One's influence and everything to do with her realization that no one could meet her standards, I'm guessing it also had to do with a sense of self-actualization. As the second after Shamael to go to the Shadow, she did it less for nihilistic philosophical issues and more from a sense of grandiose superiority and actual evil. She's a bad person. It seems that her work in mental health made her feel that people would be happiest of all with no thoughts in their heads beyond worship and adoration of her, but only if they met her standards of beauty and power. Otherwise, they're better off dead. She is aimed at a future where she is nameless, and the best specimens exist to serve her, and that's all, because nothing else is worth having. And until then, she's going to get her rocks off out in Natron's Barrow and conspire with the others and outsmart them and outmatch them. And in meeting Grendel in this book, I always liked her, long before I knew her deeper foundations and motivations, which are frankly troubling, but there was no way to guess that she would be one of the longest-lasting and most effective of the Chosen, and I love that about her. I love the fact that her long game outlives Lanfear's long game, partly because she's better at controlling her impulses. And Grendel is probably my favorite Forsaken, partly just because she's so smart and so devious, and also just because she would rather be in a void. She doesn't want to have to deal with governance or bureaucracy or anything like that, which I appreciate because I'm lazy too. So as of Book 5, we learn about every Forsaken but Mesaana. RJ has us meet and interact or at least hear some manner of anecdote about them. We don't meet Semiraj or Demandred in Book 5, but we hear little bits. So we at least get something fleshed out. We hear that Demandred hates Rand, or that Ravan is of the opinion that Demandred thinks he's the Great Lord's heir. RJ also uses Asmodean to fill Rand in about the Forsaken, so Rand learns that Demandred went to the Shadow because he envied Luthor and Telamon, which confuses him because he can't fathom taking any action whatsoever out of envy, which, me too, Rand. And we get hints of Semiraj's proclivities when Rand thinks that he wishes Asmodean hadn't told him what she found amusing. So we basically have a foundation for all of the Forsaken in some form except for Mesaana, who we then get a POV from in Book 6. So at the start of the Fires of Heaven, 9 of the 13 Forsaken still live. Baelal is permanently dead. Aghanor and Balthamel won't be reincarnated until the prologue of the next book, and Ashamael doesn't come back as Moradin until Book 7. We see that the Forsaken are prone to conspire, and that they have kind of cliques. Lanfear, Samael, Grendel, and Ravan form a group, or Lanfear manipulates them into a group, and they work together. And we actually learn later on in Book 6 that Demandred, Semiraj, and Mesaana grouped together and worked together even back in the day, during the War of the Shadow. So, we've got Forsaken who have goals. They are aimed at various targets depending on their personal preferences and talents, and they have plans for the Day of Return. And then RJ gives us some aimless Forsaken, who are rather poorly adapted to the Third Age, and so that they aren't totally without purpose, he kind of uses them as support staff. Asmodian and Mogadian are compelling villains partly because they don't seem to be seeking some great power. They just want to survive. And Mogadian does this by hiding. The others take their pick of nations. They pick powerful nations. They pick nations that have their shit together, or, in the case of Grendel, a nation that will be easier to control because it doesn't have its shit together. Mogadian chooses the shit show that is Tanchico, and she does in large part because nobody else wants it, but also because it has libraries full of information she is seeking so she can better understand, dude, what happened. And there are also artifacts in the Panarch's palace for her to pick through. And her original beef with Nynaeve begins because Nynaeve and Elaine fucked it up. She had a comfortable setup in Tanchico, and she was looking around and spidering her way and taking her time, and then Nynaeve and Elaine come in and tromp through her proverbial flower bed. And it says, "All my careful planning ruined," Mogadian said abruptly in a tight, angry voice, white-knuckled hands gripping her skirts. "At the very least, I shall have to go to untold effort to put everything back as it was. It may not be possible. Oh, I do mean to make you pay for that, Nynaeve Valmira. This has been such a cozy hiding place, and those blind women have a number of very useful items in their possession, even if they do not—" She shook her head, lips peeling back to bare her teeth in a snarl. "I think I will take you with me this time. I know. I shall keep you for a live mounting block. You will be brought out to kneel on all fours so I can step from your back to my saddle. Or perhaps I shall give you to Ravan. He always repays favors. He does have a pretty little queen to amuse him now, but pretty women were always Ravan's weakness. He likes to have two or three or four at once dancing attendants on him. How will you like that? To spend the rest of your life competing for Ravan's favors. You will want to once he has his hands on you. He has his little tricks. Yes, I do believe Ravan shall have you." So, a little bit of awesome foreshadowing. This is happening while they're having their battle in the Panarch's Palace at the end of Book 4, and at the end of Book 5, Nynaeve is going to use Mogadian to melt Ravan's face. So, Mogadian's already got it in for Nynaeve, and is already planning to do terrible things just because she's annoyed about having her hiding place upset. And then Nynaeve beats her during this battle that they're having in the Panarch's Museum, something that Mogadian never in a million years believed that she could do. And maybe one of the things that makes her so angry is that Nynaeve kind of cheated by grabbing an item and throwing it at her, like beaning her in the head with the necklace from the Domination Bands as for an Age of Legends person so far outside the box of what is appropriate to do for a duel with the One Power that it's like a groin strike in MMA or boxing. It's just not a fair fight at that point. The Big White Book of Bad Art says about Mogadian. Before going over to the Shadow, Lilin Moiril was an advisor for investments, a profession that no source explains. Whatever the work entailed, it is recorded that she was cautioned a number of times and even disciplined for violating its ethics and the laws surrounding it. She went over to the Shadow long before the War of Power began, but managed to keep her alliance a secret until the war had been raging for several years. During that time, she acted as a spy and agent provocateur, having secured a medium-level position in Luz Theron's command and staff structure. Several major disasters in the early years of the war can be directly attributed to her machinations. Mogadian has been described as a natural-born skulker and as an out-and-out coward who scoffed at those who took open risks, but at the same time envied their achievements and hated them because she was sure they despised her for hanging back. It is known that a number of the other Forsaken did, in fact, look down on her, yet those who discounted her too far usually lived to regret it. Many people did not live to regret it. While she was never known to confront an enemy openly unless she had the upper hand or was forced to, it was said she could remember a slight until the wheel of time stopped turning. How she was revealed to be a supporter of the Shadow is not known, but it is recorded that she barely escaped capture and that several thousand people, few in any way connected to the attempt to detain her, were killed as a diversion during that escape, a matter of sabotaging a public transport system. It is known that she had a very effective intelligence and sabotage network, one which may in fact have been under her control well before this. Some sources say that as many deaths may be laid at Mogadian's feet as at those of any general of the Shadow, but few of her victims were soldiers. Her greatest asset was her ability within the World of Dreams. Within its dimensions, her skills surpassed even Lanfear's, despite the latter's claim of sovereignty. So Mageddon was a Wall Street crook, like a Bernie Madoff sort before the Boar. And I'm guessing, for her, the attraction of the Shadow is just the ability to do whatever she wants and not get in trouble for it. And also, if she sincerely believed that they were going to lose to the Shadow, then for her, going to the Shadow would be the right choice just because she wants to survive. As a fundamental coward, and as someone who obviously lacks conscience, I mean, she blew up a train station, it sounds like, in order to be able to get away and kill thousands of people. You know, for her, saving her own skin and doing whatever the fuck she feels like is basically her MO. But she gets out of the Boar and is just kind of spinning her wheels in the Third Age, because none of the things that she's good at are things that will help her gain power or rule, and none of the actions that she takes are toward that goal. Instead, she's trying to lie low and watch the others be killed off, and just sort of waiting to ride it out, and very happy for all of them to kill each other or to be killed off by Rand. Or if she can keep in the shadows and stealth pick some of them off, great. But she's not super invested in making any moves, because she's got time. The bolder chosen, who are aimed at loftier heights, can take all the risks and helpfully reduce the number of enemies she has to be worried about in the process. She'll just spy at them from the shadows and figure out what they're up to. Mogedion is really interesting, and we get to know her as Nynaeve's nemesis in this book. She fixates on Nynaeve because she doesn't fear her, and it gives her purpose. Nynaeve is an enemy that Mogedion actually feels comfortable fighting. She's nursing this grudge, and she intends to get payback. And Nynaeve, with the help of Birgitta, hunts her in turn. And when Birgitta finds her, she takes Nynaeve to spy on Mogedion, spying on a meeting between Ravan, Samael, Lanfear, and Grendel. Birgitta and Nynaeve are dropped into the middle of a conversation that they're all having, floating in these chairs in Tel Iron Riad, with Grendel saying to Samael, "You've never been a coward, so why start now?" And it says, "No one names me coward," he said harshly, "but if we continue as we are, he will come straight from my throat." "That has been the plan from the beginning," said a woman's melodious voice. "He will concentrate on you," the big man said in a deep voice. "If need be, one close to him will die, plainly at your order. He will come for you, and while he is fixed on you alone, the three of us linked will take him. What has changed to alter any of that?" "Nothing has changed," the scarred man growled. "Least of all my trust for you. I will be part of the link, or it ends now." The golden-haired woman threw back her head and laughed. "Poor man," she said mockingly, waving a beringed hand at him. "Do you think he would not notice that you were linked? He has a teacher, remember? A poor one, but not a complete fool. Next you will ask to include enough of those Black Aja children to take the circle beyond 13, so you or Ravan must have control." "If Ravan trusts us enough to link when he must allow one of us to guide," the melodious voice said, "you can display an equal trust." The big man looked into his goblet, and the mist-clad woman smiled faintly. "If you cannot trust us not to turn on you," the unseen woman continued, "then trust that we will be watching each other too closely to turn. You agreed to all of this, Samael. Why do you begin to quibble now?" So, this scene is after Rand and the Aiel have crossed into Kyrian. So, there has been an attack in the Jangai Pass, with Shadow Spawn and Dark Friend shouting, "Samael and the Golden Bees!" It's the first of a number of attacks designed to bait Rand. Mogedion is keeping tabs on every Forsaken, and we have to assume that she's been doing that since she got out. And they make it easy for her because of how much they like to use Tel Iron Riad. She considers the World of Dreams her domain. Lanfear might like to think it belongs to her, but as far as Mogedion is concerned, she's like, "I'm the most talented dreamer among all of the Forsaken, and if you're going to come onto my playground, I'm going to come and peep at you and listen in on your secret meetings, because I can." And so, presumably, any of the meetings that the Forsaken have had in the World of Dreams since they got out, Mogedion has been spying on. Knowledge is power, and that's crucial to someone whose greatest aim is to survive. And I can't imagine her ever really wanting to rule, because rulers are targets, and she's not interested in being a target. She wants to do her own thing and basically just be able to be her evil self without too much attention on her. So I feel like Mogedion is very poorly suited to be a Forsaken in the Third Age. At the least, she's not well suited to this war to be Nae'blis. It was fine when it was just being one of many evil people in the Age of Legends supporting an evil war effort. But when there's only a handful of you and the whole point is there can be only one, she's not doing so great. But she's doing better than Asmodian, who is guilty of, as Robin puts it in the prologue, trusting Lanfear behind him and thus deserving the knife that he gets in his back. Asmodian has no skills to adapt to the Third Age, except those that would earn him meals and beds as a glee man. He has no abilities to help him secure power, and that's not his thing anyway. This world has nothing to scratch his evil itch. Asmodian, of all of them, is the one to wake up and be like, "Dude, what happened?" and then feel real fucking depressed about it and just want to get a drink, because for him especially, it's the worst news. The Big White Book of Bad Art says about Asmodian, who we know, as he tells Rand at the end of The Shadow Rising, was called Jor-Adam Nisosan. It says, "He was a child prodigy in both composition and performance on a wide range of instruments. Jor-Adam never fulfilled his early promise, at least never to the extent expected. Works he composed while as young as 15 were performed in many of the great cities of the world, but he never rose to the exalted heights that many had foretold, and was never ranked among the great composers of the age. It is reliably reported that his reason for dedicating his soul to the shadow was the promise of immortality. With eternity at his disposal, surely he would reach that greatness, and perhaps even more important, the recognition of it that had eluded him. It is believed that he never held any field commands, though he did take part in a number of battles on some level, and served as a governor of conquered areas. By and large, his administrations were not particularly horrific compared with others of the Forsaken. The one atrocity which was specifically his has been overlooked by some historians, because it involved fewer people. It should not be. Artists of all sorts, of whom he disapproved, were blinded and or otherwise maimed. Any artist, writer, musician, any at all, could become an object of Asmodian's displeasure, but it was most particularly aimed at musicians and composers who had been considered his rivals before the war. The horror of this can only be compounded by the fact that there was no torture involved as such. The unfortunate was simply made incapable of producing his or her art again and then released." So that's fucked up. And I don't know if that's psychopathy or sociopathy or narcissism or something else, but a person who ended up not being as special as they were supposed to be and who goes on to feel the need to de-talent others is deeply disturbed. And if the story that Lanfear tells Rand of Asmodian severing his own mother and letting Myrdal drag her away is a true story, I wonder if his mother was horrible to him, giving him shit for not reaching greatness, neglecting to fulfill expectations that perhaps she had for him. And that doesn't excuse any of the stuff that he does, but it's just interesting, especially because you only do that to someone you have such an intimate connection with when you have a deep, deep hatred for them. And there's a special kind of hatred that a broken, twisted child can have for a toxic, emotionally abusive parent. And if Asmodian is so desperate not just to be great, but so threatened by the greatness of others that he has to maim them in horrible ways, not out of sadistic cruelty, but out of a desire to sever them from their art, the level of childish selfishness driving that, it's just, the psychology of it is so troubling and interesting, and it's just, it's a strange kind of evil. And he chose the dark for immortality, not power and not greatness. His darkest desire is to be great, but the shadow can't give him that. What he wants is time. It's like, I have to be immortal because I have to have enough time that eventually I'll be able to be great. I'll finally be able to be good enough. I'll finally manage whatever it takes to be able to get to that point of greatness. I just need more time. And that's interesting. And nothing that drives him suits him to survive the Third Age. He has no sense of competition with the current artists of the age. His inherent Aes Sedai from the Age of Legends superiority about everything has to include artists and musicians. The breaking destroyed Asmodian's competition. He was expecting art and music to continue to evolve and improve, and instead it regressed. It's effortless to be a greater composer than any of the other ones that are alive now, the people of this age, and even if he was considered the greatest by them, he wouldn't feel very happy about it, because it's like, who fucking cares what they think? The only peers he has will never give him approval, because he's the weakest dog in the pack, and they all look down on him. So, nothing about this situation will make him happy. So of these Forsaken, Asmodean has the least to work for. He has the least to make him feel any kind of drive or hope. He has the most to fear, and so he accepts Lanfear's offer to work with her to aid Luzetheran Reborn. He doesn't trust her, but he doesn't know what to do, and she's a powerful ally who comes to him with a plan, and because he's just sort of like, what happened? And also aimless, so aimless. Asmodean won't survive on his own, at least not unless he hides the way Mogedion hides, and somebody like him, who's looking for greatness and needs people to pay attention to him, would probably prefer death to hiding. So he hopes for reflected greatness from Rand. As Lanfear says, in Asmodean's dreams, he's dreaming of Rand putting him up alongside him. And before Rand captures him, in Book 4, when Asmodean, Lanfear, Kadir, and Isendra first come into the Waste with all of the peddler's wagons, back when he thinks that he's still going to be a man of power and that he and Lanfear are in this as equals, Asmodean seems to be hoping to use Rand as a muse. The first night they meet with the peddlers, it says, Natael drew Rand aside that first evening after the fires were lit and cooking smells began to drift among the low tents. The Glee Man seemed almost as nervous as Kadir. "I've thought a good deal about you," he said, peering at Rand sideways, head tilted to one side. "You should have a grand epic to tell your tale. The dragon reborn, he who comes with the dawn, man of who knows how many prophecies in this age and others." He drew his cloak around him, the colorful patches fluttering in the breeze. Twilight was short in the waste. Night and cold came on quickly and together. "How do you feel about your prophecy destiny? I must know if I'm to compose this epic." "Feel?" Rand looked around the camp, at the Jindo moving among the tents. How many of them would be dead before he was done? Tired. I feel tired. Hardly a heroic emotion, Natael murmured, but to be expected given your destiny. The world riding on your shoulders. Most people willing to kill you given the chance. The rest fools who think to use you, ride you to power and glory. Which are you, Natael? I am a simple Glee Man. The man lifted an edge of his patch-covered cloak as if for proof. I would not take your place for all the world, not with the fate that accompanies it, death or madness or both. And a little bit further it says, Natael returned the next evening, and the next, always talking about the epic he would compose, but he displayed a morbid streak, digging for how Rand meant to face madness and death. His tale was meant to be a tragedy, it appeared. Rand certainly had no desire to root his fears out into the open. What was in his heart and head could remain buried there. Finally, the Glee Man seemed to tire of hearing him say, I will do what I must, and stopped coming. It seemed that he did not want to compose his epic unless it could be full of pained emotion. The man looked frustrated when he stalked off for the last time, cloak fluttering furiously behind him. So, originally I thought that Asmodean was seeking to use Rand as inspiration, and that's what he's doing in this scene. And I think that's true to a certain extent, because what could be a greater subject matter to inspire an epic for all of the ages than the Champion of the Light? But I realized, while I was doing the rough draft, that Asmodean is feeling Rand out with this tale, and expecting him to pick up what he's putting down. He's trying to craft a cover story, what ends up more or less being their cover story in the end, that Natael is the Glee Man to the Dragon Reborn, but Asmodean seems to be expecting an emotionally symbiotic relationship, something on his terms, and also, I guess, assuming that Rand will understand what is happening here and say, okay, what do you really want, you know? Is your name Asmodean? Are we going to start having a lesson here? But Rand is so dense, he thinks Kadir is actually the male Forsaken that Lanfear has brought with her. And so, because he assumes that it's Kadir, he doesn't understand the actual purpose of this conversation that Asmodean keeps having with him, or that Natael keeps initiating and ends up driving Asmodean away. And because Asmodean gets no commitment from Rand, and presumably when he takes Matt aside and asks him questions about Roydian and all the shit that he saw, Matt must have mentioned seeing the statuettes, because once Asmodean realizes that Rand is a stick in the mud and isn't going to pick up what he's putting down and be a path to glory, he's finally like, okay, fuck this, there's better shit to do. So he laser engraves the dragons onto Culloden so he can cause Rand trouble and be a distraction. Because with a powerful Sangreal, Asmodean can ride the time out before the day of return in relative safety. Anybody will think 10 times before attacking him when he's holding the male chode on call. At Alcair Dal, when they have the breaking in the threefold land at the end of the Shadow Rising, where Rand is revealed to be he who comes with the dawn after Cúlladin falsely claims that it is actually he, there's the big fuck-around where everybody gets real overwrought and Rand has to make it rain to get them all to calm down. And Lanfear finally shows up while it's raining, and she makes this dome that separates her and Rand, and it says, "I didn't expect you to reveal yourself yet," he said quietly. The power still filled him. He rode the buffeting torrents, holding on with a desperation he kept out of his voice. It was not necessary to pull in more, only to let it come till it seemed his bones would crisp to ash. He did not know if she could shield him while Sidene actually roared through him, but he let it fill him against the possibility. "I know you are not alone. Where is he?" Lanfear's beautiful mouth tightened. "I knew he would give himself away, coming into your dream. I could have managed matters if his panic—" "I knew from the start," he broke in. "I expected it from the day I left the Stone of Tyr. Out here, where anyone could see I was fixed on Roydian and the Aiel. Do you think I did not expect some of you to come after me? But the trap is mine, Lanfear, not yours. Where is he?" The last came as a cold shout. Emotion skittered uncontrollably around the void that surrounded him inside, the emptiness that was not empty, the emptiness filled with the power. "If you knew," she snapped back, "why did you chase him away with your talk of fulfilling your destiny, of doing what has to be done?" Scorn weighted the words like stones. "I brought Asmodean to teach you, but he was always one to leap to another plan if the first proved difficult. Now he thinks he has found something better for himself in Roydian, and he is off to take it while you stand here. Cúlladin, the Drakkar, all to hold your attention while he made sure. All my plans for nothing because you must be stubborn. Do you have any idea what effort it will take to convince him again? It must be him. Demandred or Ravan or Samael would kill you before teaching you to lift a hand unless they have you bound like a dog at heel." And Saran is like, "Oh, shit. Okay." And he skims to Roydian, and he and Asmodean fight over the chode on call. And because Rand has the fat little man on Greal, he uses that little extra bit of power to cut Asmodean off from the Dark One, which really fucks him up. And Lanfear shows up again, and it says, "I do like to see men fight." "Me too, Lanfear." "But you two cannot even stand." Lanfear moved into Rand's view, surveying the devastation. "You have made a thorough job of it. Can you feel the traces? This place was shielded in some way. You did not leave enough for me to say how." Dark eyes suddenly bright, she knelt in front of Rand, peering at what he held. "So that is what he was after. I thought they were all destroyed. Only half remains of the single one I have seen. A fine trap for some unwary Aes Sedai." She put out a hand and he clutched the Tirangriel tighter. Her smile did not touch her eyes. "Keep it, certainly. To me it is no more than a figurine." Rising, she dusted her white skirts, though they did not need it. When she realized he was watching her, she stopped searching the rubble-strewn plaza with her eyes, made her smile brighter. "What you used was one of the two Sangreal I told you of. Did you feel the immensity of it? I have wondered what it must be like." She seemed unaware of the hunger in her voice. "With those, together, we can displace the great Lord of the Dark himself. We can, Luthéren, together." "Help me?" Asmodean crawled toward her unsteadily, his upraised face painted in dread. "You don't know what he has done. You must help me. I would not have come here if not for you." "What has he done?" she sniffed. "Beaten you like a dog, and not half so well as you deserve. You were never meant for greatness, Asmodean, only to follow those who are great." Somehow, Rand managed to stand, still holding the stone and crystal figure to his chest. He would not continue on his knees in her presence. "You chosen." He knew taunting her was dangerous, but he could not stop himself. "Gave your souls to the Dark One. You let him attach himself to you." How many times had he replayed his battle with Balzamon? How many times before he began to suspect what those black wires were? "I cut him off from the Dark One, Lanfear. I cut him off." Her eyes widened in shock, staring from him to Asmodean. The man had begun to weep. "I did not think that was possible." "Why? Do you think to bring him to the light? You've changed nothing about him." "He is still the same man who gave himself to the Shadow in the first place," Rand agreed. "You told me how little you'd chosen trust one another. How long could he keep it secret? How many of you would believe he didn't do it himself somehow? I am glad you thought it impossible. Maybe the rest of you will as well. You gave me the whole idea, Lanfear, a man to teach me how to control the power, but I won't be taught by a man linked to the Dark One. Now I don't have to be. He may be the same man, but he doesn't have much choice, does he? He can stay and teach me, hope I win, help me win, or he can hope the rest of you don't take the excuse to turn on him. Which do you think he'll choose? Asmodean stared wild-eyed at Rand from his crouch, then thrust out a pleading hand toward Lanfear.
They will believe you. You can tell them. I would not be here except for you. You must tell them. I'm faithful to the great Lord of the Dark.
Lanfear stared at Rand, too. For the first time ever that he had seen, she looked uncertain.
How much do you remember, Luce Theron? How much is you and how much the Shepherd? This is the sort of plan you might have devised when we—
Drawing a deep breath, she turned her head to Asmodean.
Yes, they will believe me when I tell them you went over to Luce Theron. Everyone knows you will leap wherever you think your best chance lies. There, she nodded to herself in satisfaction. Another little present for you, Luce Theron. That shield will allow a trickle through, enough for him to teach. It will dissipate with time, but he'll not be able to challenge you for months, and by that time he will have no choice but to remain with you. He was never very good at breaking through a shield. You must be willing to accept pain, and he never could.
So she fucks Asmodean over, which was more or less her plan from the start. You know, she tells Rand when she's talking to him in the Stone of Tyr in Book 4, we can kill Asmodean too once he's taught you. The Dark One isn't going to give a shit. And RJ goes into the fires of heaven, playing out the consequences of Lanfear's forsaken fuckery in the Shadow Rising. We aren't given a specific timeline for how long it's been since Asmodean's capture in the prologue when we have the meeting with Robin and Samael and Grendel and Lanfear, but it's probably at least a month. And the reason that I say that is because the Dark Hounds get sent to kill Rand in Chapter 6, and Lanfear tells him Robin sent them as soon as he found out where Rand was. I'm guessing Robin learned his whereabouts from Lanfear in that meeting, and it's been at least a month that Rand has been in Roydian. So, after Lanfear tells Robin and Grendel and Samael, hey, Ishamael tried to control him, tried to kill him and failed, but Ishamael tried bullying and fear. Bullying doesn't work with Rand al-Thor. She says, we can succeed where Ishamael failed. She was leaning slightly forward as if to force the words on them. Lanfear seldom showed tension. Why now?
Why only we four? Robin asked. The other why would have to wait.
Why more? Was Lanfear's reply. If we can present the Dragon Reborn kneeling to the Great Lord on the Day of Return, why share the honor and the rewards further than need be? And perhaps he can even be used to, how did you put it, Samael, whittle away the dead wood. It was the sort of answer Robin could understand. Not that he trusted her, of course, or any of the others, but he understood ambition. The Chosen had plotted among themselves for position up to the day Luce Theron had imprisoned them in sealing up the Great Lord's prison, and they had begun again the day they were freed. He just had to be sure Lanfear's plot did not disrupt his own plans.
Speak on, he told her.
First, someone else is trying to control him, perhaps to kill. I suspect Mogedion or Demandred. Mogedion has always tried to work from the shadows, and Demandred always did hate Luce Theron. Samael smiled, or perhaps grimaced, but his hatred was a pale thing beside Demandred's, though for better cause.
How do you know it is not one of us here? Grendel asked glibly. Lanfear's smile showed as many teeth as the other woman's and his little warmth.
Because you three choose to carve out niches for yourself and secure your power while the rest slash at each other. And other reasons. I told you I keep a close watch on Rand al-Thor.
It was true what she said of them. Robin himself preferred diplomacy and manipulation to open conflict, though he would not shy from it if needed. Samael's way had always been armies and conquest. He would not go near Luce Theron, even reborn as a shepherd, until he was sure of victory. Grendel, too, followed conquest, though her methods did not involve soldiers. For all her concern with her toys, she took one solid step at a time, openly, to be sure, as the Chosen reckoned such things, but never stretching too far at any step.
You know I can keep an eye on him unseen, Lanfear continued, but the rest of you must stay clear or run the risk of detection. We must draw him back.
Grendel leaned forward, interested, and Samael began to nod as she went on. Robin reserved judgment. It might well work, and if not, he saw several ways to shape events to his advantage. This might work out very well indeed. So,
First off, I don't know if Lanfear is being truthful when she's saying someone else is trying to control him or perhaps kill him. I've thought it through and tried to imagine what she's talking about, and the only thing that I can think of is that she doesn't know who sent the Trollocs to rescue Rand and the Stone of Tyr in Book 4, countering the Trollocs that Samael sent. And Rand asks her, "Hey, are you responsible for this?" And she hesitates and then is like, "If I take credit, you might expect it again." And we hear in Lord of Chaos that Semiraj was responsible, and that she got orders telling her to send Trollocs to counter Samael's attack. But Lanfear doesn't know who was behind it. And that's the only reason I can think of, the only example of an unknown quantity where Lanfear would suspect another Chosen's designs. Or else she's lying to them and saying that somebody else is trying to control or kill, and it honestly doesn't matter either way. Beyond it being a plot thread, I was never able to find or figure out. Secondly, she's saying, "We must draw him back." There's nothing to indicate that the Shido choice to go over the Dragon Wall is fueled by anything but Culloden/Savannah's ambition. We know that Savannah is eventually making choices based upon Samael's fuckery, but she specifically states that he approaches her in Kinslayer's Dagger as Kadar. Nothing is given to us to indicate Shido contact with the Shadow before that point. But maybe it's fueled by the Shadow. Whatever the case, chapters 2 through 7 take place over approximately 12 hours in Roydian before Rand hears that the Shido are heading for the Jangai Pass and packs everyone up to cross the Dragon Wall following after. Rand and Matt get attacked by Dark Hounds, Lanfear shows up to tell Rand that they're from Raven and that Borghese is a captive, and Matt ends up hooking up with Melindra, who presumably got dream instructions, as when Nynaeve spies on Mogedion, who is spying on her four conspirators, she hears Raven tell Samael, "If necessary, one close to Rand may die." So a sleeper agent is put in place so that if it's necessary, Matt will die to goad Rand into attacking Samael. So the aim of our Forsaken conspirators is to goad Rand to attack Samael. In other words, to bully him to get the desired results, after Lanfear has said, "Bullying doesn't work on Rand Althor." She knows none of this is going to work. So what's her real goal? To keep the three greatest threats to Rand away from him, so that he can learn to channel. She doesn't believe he's going to go after Samael. Or maybe she thinks if he does, if he disappoints her by actually falling for it, she'll demand that he say he will be hers forever, and then she'll help him. But from her understanding of Rand, she assumes that it's actually not going to work, and he won't attack Samael. Still, she tells these three, "Hey, we've got a plan that's going to fuck with Rand. We'll capture him and give him to the Dark One, and you should keep your distance until he falls into the trap," even though she has no intention of actually hatching a plan with them. She's giving Rand time to learn and directing these great threats away from him. The Daughter of the Night has had a long game running since she first walked again, and she's making use of her fellow Forsaken to serve her aims so that Luce Theron will love her and they can challenge the Creator. It's a pretty good game, but she derails it by having poor emotional regulation and impulse control. And also, it was doomed to fail, because, sorry, Lanfear, but he's just not that into you.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. This one took forever. My job kind of gets in the way of my productivity, and sorry about that. It's going to be slow going for now, but I'm focusing on quality over quantity. This episode took a little longer than I expected because I couldn't figure out how to structure it. I hope you like how it turned out. My rough drafts are now available on Patreon. They'll be uploaded 2 to 3 weeks before the final, and you'll be able to see how it improved, what I added, and what I cut out. If you'd like to support the show and have access to that or other fun content, there's a link in the show notes. There are other links to my Discord, to my email, to the Watt Trivia and Games Discord, and to the Watt Fandom and Calendar Discord. And there's a link to my YouTube, you should go and subscribe, as well as to my Twitter handle, if anybody still wants to do Twitter after Elon Musk took it over, at Pod of the Dragon. There's also a link to Apple Podcasts. If you could review my show, I'd appreciate it. It will help other people find me. So will word of mouth. So if you know anyone who likes the Wheel of Time and might be interested in a different kind of podcast, please tell them about me. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. My name is Morgan,
And if I woke after 3,000 years to learn that the man I had been so totally caught up in was reborn as a stubborn, oblivious woolhead, instead of conspiring with my frenemies, I'd be making a Tinder profile. I don't get it, Lanfear.